Is everyone, are all council on, Pam? Okay. Marshall, if you want to call us to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Hooten, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have six cases on our calendar this morning, three for oral argument. And the first case this morning is A20-0739, Joseph Roach et al. Appellants versus Thomas Alinder et al. Respondents, Alinders and Gary Heidkamp Construction respondents. First of all, if I could get counsel just to introduce themselves and who they are representing. So we know that, and I want to talk to respondents counsel about splitting time. So for the appellants, we have who? Who's arguing for appellants? Oh, and gone. There we go.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Mr. Grand, is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're representing the appellants?
I am, Your Honor.
Great, thank you. And for respondents?
Michael Morley, Your Honor. I represent Gary Heidkamp and Gary Heidkamp Construction, Inc.
Thank you. Mr. Lamb?
Stephen Lamb. I'm here representing Thomas and Sandra Allender.
Allenders. Great. Okay, thank you. And counsel for respondents, will you be splitting your time?
Yes.
Who's going first?
Mr. Morley wants me to go first. I'll be short 5-7 minutes and he can have the bulk of it because his brief is bulkier too.
Okay, well, we'll have the marshal, I guess, give you seven, or do you
seven.
Prefer five?
Yes,
seven?
I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, that's confusing.
Okay, the marshal gives 7 minutes, 8 minutes for Mr. Morley. We can figure it out and we'll make adjustments along the way if it changes a little bit. Okay, that sounds good. So we will just mute our audio when we're not talking. Everyone will try and remember to do that. And otherwise, I think we are ready to go. Any questions before we start? Great. Okay. So we'll start with the first case, as I say, Roach versus Allender and Heidkamp Construction. And counsel for appellant, if you could, for the record, please state your name, the party you represent, and you will have 15 minutes for your primary, your principal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Dennis Grand. I'm with the firm of DeWitt, Maple, Crumps, and Moore. And I represent the Roaches, who are the appellants in this case. May I proceed, Your Honor?
Please do. Thank you. Thank you.
And you can hear me? I'm unmuted. Thank
yep,
you. Thank
you. Sound great.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is the fifth time that this case has come before the Court of Appeals. This whole case started back in 2004. In 2019, in April, it finally got to a trial. A jury awarded the plaintiffs, my clients, the appellants, $564,800. That was in April of 2019. In October of 2019, we, the Roaches, the appellants here, accepted a remitter of future damages only. And then after the final judgment, we accepted the remitter. There was a final judgment issued in the next month or 45 days. And we appealed from the final judgment on issues separate and distinct from the remitter of future damages. And I emphasize separate and distinct because those are the words that this Court of Appeals used in issuing a decision after all these briefs were written in July 27th of this year. That decision plays into this case because your decision on the separate and distinct issues and being able to appeal those issues differs from what Judge Carlson, the district court judge, said. The district court judge said, you accept the remitter on future damages, the case is over. And
counsel, I think we're familiar with the underlying facts. If we could get to the issue about the post, the accrual of post-judgment interest, can you explain to me what would be the purpose of depositing the funds in court other than to stop the accrual of post-judgment interest?
Well, frequently you have a non-stakeholder holding the proceeds. Frequently it's an insurance company. Frequently it's a bank. Those people don't want to be involved in the litigation. They don't want the expense. They don't want potential exposure in excess of the amount of money that they think that they're holding. So they make that deposit. That happens all the time. But that's before we know. That's before the litigants know who's going to get the money. In other words, the insurance company doesn't care who gets the money. They just don't want to be involved. In this case, a decision was already reached. Remitter was already taken. We already accepted the remitter. So that's our money. That's the appellant's money deposited with the court. Now, the reason
can I ask, or I don't know if I interrupted, if you had further response to Judge Frisch's question. Did you want to continue?
I did. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Why would somebody do that? Well, if you can stop interest running, interest on any verdict, any civil verdict over 50,000 is 10%. The interest rate on a deposit in court is, I don't know, it's 1 or 2%. It's essentially nothing. And so there is a tremendous incentive to deposit it with the court if you can get somebody to believe that they're that halts judgment interest.
But that really doesn't answer my question, because why would it be that an insurance company could deposit money into court and stop the accrual of post-judgment interest, but a litigant couldn't do that?
Well, I mean, it doesn't normally happen in post-judgment situations. It happens when the lawsuit starts. A stakeholder is involved, or a stakeholder is holding the money, but doesn't want to be. And so that's when it occurs. It has nothing to do with post-judgment interest. As a matter of fact, no Minnesota case has ever held that the accrual of post-judgment interest halts upon the deposit of funds under 6701.
Can we look at the federal rule? Would you agree that there are federal Rule 67 cases that halt the accrual of post-judgment interest upon deposit in the court?
I don't know that, Your Honor. I can't answer that question. I can tell you this, that the statute 549.09 subdivision 2 does not halt interest. And it does not for ascertainability requirement or for the valid tender argument judgment. And the Hoganson case in 2014 is very specific that all cases that have judgments should be calculated. The post-judgment interest should be calculated under 549.09.
Right. Okay. So as for federal cases, then I guess if you're unfamiliar with them, if federal cases under the federal rule would conclude that post-judgment interest would stop in these circumstances, is there any difference? I assume that you don't have any argument that the federal rule is somehow different from the state rule, except with the exception, I guess, that you're looking at 549 and saying that our rule? I'm just comparing the rules to see if there's any difference between the two.
Well, I can make this analogy. When I argued several months ago about the applicability of remitter and whether remitter ended the whole case or not, there are federal decisions that say remitter, acceptance of remitter ends the whole case. We argued and Minnesota had not decided that issue, but other states had and other federal districts had. And in that case, the court here in July of this year, this court ruled in favor of permitting appeals on separate and separate distinct issues in contravention to what federal courts typically do. So the fact that the federal court, the federal rule may, and I don't know that, I'm sorry, I don't know that, may halt interest doesn't mean that Minnesota did, does, or should.
So let me ask you this, counsel. So as I understand, I mean, this is what it comes down to. There is a judgment for $500,000. Let's leave aside, let's put away the remitter issue because that's on review at the Supreme Court. It doesn't matter. And I think we could think, unless you tell me differently, we could think of this case as, and for all counsel, as let's say a plaintiff came forward with two claims, wins on one of them, loses on the other, okay? Gets a judgment on one of them. It wants to appeal the other, okay? So there's a judgment on one claim for, we'll say for $500,000. And then they're gonna appeal that second claim. But the defendant wants to pay that judgment and they want a full satisfaction of the only judgment that is there, which is $500,000. The question is, why wouldn't 549.09 let the defendant fully satisfy the judgment that exists and cut off their post-judgment interest, either by giving the full amount of the judgment in exchange for a satisfaction, or by depositing that money in court under Rule 67. Why wouldn't a defendant logically want a full satisfaction of the judgment that it is in fact paying in full, even though that has an effect on the plaintiff's appeal, I understand, in which case maybe Rule 67 should say, well, I guess that's the breaks for the plaintiff. You know, you want to go up on appeal, fine, you do that, but what you lose is the post-judgment interest on that.
There's a huge difference between your two examples. In the first example, the money is paid. The money is accessible to the appellants or to the plaintiffs. Or
what does that mean in my first example? It's accessible to them.
They pay, the defendants paid the $500,000. They get it. That's totally
they pay it different. If they get a full satisfaction of it. I think that's where the rub is here, right? They want to pay the complete judgment and get a full satisfaction. And I think the Roaches said, we won't give a full satisfaction. We'll give a partial satisfaction of the $500,000 verdict, even though it's being paid in full, because a full satisfaction is going to hurt us on appeal on the remainder of our claims.
So I don't understand what the question is. That
I guess, I mean, the question is, your view is that the Roaches should be able to pursue, and maybe you're right, I'm trying to understand it, Roaches should be able to pursue additional claims for the attorney's fees, for the pre-verdict interest and stuff. But at the same time, they're earning 10% on the, or whatever, I think that's what it is, on the post-judgment, on the judgment and interest. Even though the defendants in fact want to pay that $500,000.
Well, if they want to pay it, then they get a satisfaction for that amount, and the money then is accessible to the Roaches.
But so what does that mean? What does a satisfaction on that amount mean if they're paying the full amount? That's what I couldn't quite figure out. If they're paying the full amount of the judgment, and you say they get a satisfaction on that amount, and that amount is the full amount of the judgment, is that not a full satisfaction of the judgment? Like, were you seeking with a partial satisfaction if they're paying it in full? I didn't quite understand
We're seeking the right to continue and argue the issues that are separate and distinct. Those issues are attorney's fees under the statute, whether or not the county should have been on the verdict form And then post.
I understand what else you wanted, but just tell me, like, mechanically, if there's a judgment for $500,000 and the obligor pays $500,000 and then wants a full satisfaction that they paid, a satisfaction that they paid that amount in full. Is that a different satisfaction than they paid that amount in full, but you get to pursue other? I'm just not actually sure what that document looks like. What is that satisfaction of judgment that you're seeking?
The satisfaction would waive what they want. A full satisfaction waives any and all claims the plaintiffs have against the defendants. A partial satisfaction for $500,000 satisfies all claims against the defendants, except on the issues that are separate and distinct.
So full satisfaction isn't just a satisfaction of a full judgment paid. You're saying that they want it, that it would be a satisfaction of full judgment paid, plus you don't get to seek anything more. I just don't really know what that satisfaction would look like.
Well, let me go to the second reason that Judge Carlson said that the second reason why he permitted the deposit of the money the second reason he said the court said that the deposit under 6702 was a valid tender, but it wasn't, because to be a valid tender, the offer to pay must be unconditional. And here, the full release and satisfaction is not an unconditional offer of payment. It's a waiver, it's a satisfaction of all rights the plaintiffs have against the defendant. And that's the difference. And the court said that the court concluded that it was a valid tender because what they wanted, the full satisfaction, didn't make any difference because the case ended.
Well, but counsel, the statute 54909 subdivision 2 doesn't talk about a tender. It talks about payment, but it doesn't specify to whom the judgment must be paid. It just says that the judgment must be paid. Isn't it possible that there are two reasonable interpretations of the statute? Number one, that the judgment should be paid to the judgment creditor, or number two, that the judgment could be paid into court under Rule 67. Those are two valid payments of the judgment.
It's certainly not a valid tender.
But the statute doesn't talk about a tender. It talks about paid, right?
Right, right. And the idea is you accrue interest up until the time the judgment is paid, not paid into court, but paid to the person who got the judgment, because then it's accessible. And the funds deposited were inadequate in amount. They were not unconditional, and they weren't accessible to the appellants. I mean, so interest continues to run until it's paid. It's paid not to the court, not to just another stakeholder, but paid to the successful plaintiff.
Mr. Grand, we took up a lot of time in questioning. If you want to take a minute to wrap up, you'll have also 5 minutes for rebuttal. And also, any of my colleagues have questions for you right now, of course. But
okay. So the Judge Carlson was wrong on two accounts. The ascertainability requirement, that's under the common law. We don't operate on judgments under the common law since Hoganson. It's all cases now calculated under 549. The third error that the judge committed in the district court committed is it halted post-judgment interest as of December of 19, but the money wasn't deposited until May 20th of 2020. So that's a third error that the court committed. So what we request the court to do is reverse the district court's decision, halting the accrual of post-judgment interest as of the date that we filed our appeal. appeal in Roach 4, which has already been decided. And then remand with instructions to calculate and include post-judgment interest from the day it was entered until the day it was paid. So anyway, the two reasons that the court said the court gave for its opinion was this ascertainability thing, and then the claim that the judge's opinion, the district court judge's opinion as to what was appealable, which of course turned out to be wrong because your court said you could appeal separate and distinct issues.
Okay.
If you accept the remitter on one issue, you can still appeal separate and distinct issues.
Great, thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Lamb, right? With a B?
Lamb okay. With a B.
Okay, all right, Mr. Lamb.
Baby sheep.
You have you're taking 7 minutes of this argument. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself and who you represent. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Stephen Lamb, and I represent Thomas and Sandra Allender. And may it please the court, counsel. It's our position on this that the tender, the Rule 67, the whole purpose of it is to allow the defendants or the ower the opportunity to say, this game's over, here's the money. We tried to do that when the plaintiff prevailed and there was an ascertainable amount, and they accepted the remitter. And at that time, as you can see from the addendum, there was communication like, what's your tax ID?
Let me ask this, counsel, if I may. So why, if there is a judgment, again, and we can just forget about the remitter issue, I think, because that's up there. There's a judgment on some claim, and then there's an appeal on another, okay?
Yep.
If there's a judgment on some claim, and that's going to be the least that the defendants owe, I mean, they're not appealing that. They're going to owe that. Why shouldn't they just pay it? Why should a plaintiff who wins a verdict on part of it, have to forsake the remainder of their claims and appeal on their claims when they will never not be owed the money that is that they won?
Well,
and because no one asked for a new trial here. It was hold them to the remitter. It was not going to go back to a new trial and a potential reduction. As far as I could see, that was not requested in the earlier appeal. It was $500,000 or more. Isn't that right?
Our argument to the next level is no, that's not necessarily right in this case. There is a chance that the appellants that the judgment is vacated. I mean, when they accepted the remitter,
on what grounds?
Well, because they rejected the remitter, and that vitiates the whole underlying judgment, because that's what the judgment was based on, was the remitter.
They accepted the remitter.
They accepted the remitter.
So the amount of the judgment is not going to change.
Okay. Well,
I mean, did you ask for that of us or the Supreme Court? Did you bring any sort of request to vacate or reverse the judgment? I didn't think so.
The effect
in favor of a new trial.
Right. The effect of it, though, is that if by appealing the remitter, is what our argument is, that the remitter was the acceptance of the whole judgment. And by appealing that, they have essentially vitiated the acceptance and denied the, and so the judgment is in question.
Okay, I mean, well, we'll leave that aside for a minute, but let me ask you this then. Let's just leave that aside. Is why, because I think, I mean, the questions that I was asking opposing counsel is, why is paying off the judgment, why wouldn't a payor want of satisfaction of paying that in full. But you agree, I think, with the appellant that what you were seeking was not just that you paid that judgment in full, but that that's the whole ball game. They cannot pursue any claims that they lose. And I guess I'm wondering, well, why should a, if it, I think, I mean, and this is maybe where the disagreement, I don't actually see how the judgment is ever going to go down in light of the history of this case and what the respondents have asked for. So why should a plaintiff have to forsake the rest of it if they are unquestionably entitled to that amount? Why can't there be that the defendants pay that amount is satisfied, but that it doesn't affect the remaining issues that are going up on appeal?
Well, in that case, the purpose of the Rule 67 is to hold that money in a bit. If they don't want it and they don't and they're going to want to argue other factors of the case in this instance, then that's as the court suggested, that's giving up the privilege of getting interest on that money. Either you accept the judgment on the money for and full satisfaction, or during this pendency of an appeal, the interest is held, and that's kind of what the federal court cases. And I'll let Mr. Morley talk about those because he cited quite a bit more. I cited one federal case that basically said it's just not fair. Well, you're arguing all these other matters to have interest continue to run at 10% in that case.
Run if they just paid it. If they just paid what they're going to owe, it would stop running. And then the question would be, are they ever going to win anything more? I mean, that's the best argument, right, for the appellant, is they in fact won this. And they're never not going to get it or win it. It's just whether they're going to win any more.
Well, and that's going to take me down the my argument about they're not accepting the remittiture and that sort of.
So issue. Does your argument depend on the possibility of it being reduced, of the verdict being reduced, or do you think you have some argument that even if the judgment stands as is, not the verdict, the judgment, even if the judgment stands as is, somehow for some reason, either at the point of tender, which I think that you think it shouldn't be, or Rule 67 itself provides some sort of hook for stopping post-judgment interest, even if judgment stands.
Yes, and I do think Rule 67 and the fact and the judge's analysis in this case that there was payment into the court at this point under the Rule 549, the payment has been made, and so interest does stop. And it's sitting in abeyance in that court because you have an ascertainability issue on the other issues. For instance, the attorney's fees for the watershed for the watershed matter. So yes, under Rule 67. The interest should stop, and there are other matters where interest, if you can't calculate it, then as the judge said, if you can't calculate it, if it's an unknown, then interest should not run. And that's what the federal cases say. My time is up, and I'm sure Mr. Morley will adequately address that issue.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Lamb. Mr. Morley, you will have 8 minutes if you could again introduce yourself and the parties you represent when you start.
All right, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Michael Morley. I represent the respondents Gary Heitkamp and Gary Heitkamp Construction Inc. And I hope everyone can hear me all right. Can the court hear me all right? Okay, thank you. Thank you. I guess to dovetail on what Mr. Lamb just said, and I think it was Judge Smith's concern about the two judgments. It seems to me, Your Honors, that the very least that should happen here is that under Rule 67, because of the deposit, the court should order that post-judgment interest be ended and stopped at least on the amount of the judgment that's been deposited under Rule 67.
But counsel, I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, I don't really understand why it is that this money was deposited into court, because I don't really think there, I think Judge Smith is correct. There isn't really a dispute that this money, the amount of money that was deposited into court, is owed. And it seems to me as though depositing the funds into court is serving no other purpose than to deprive the plaintiff of the judgment to which they are entitled. Is there some argument that those funds are in dispute, that they, that the plaintiffs are not entitled to those funds that have been deposited into court?
No, we do not take that position, Your Honor.
Why didn't you just pay them? Why didn't you just pay the plaintiffs?
Well, it was our position that the plaintiffs were only entitled to seek the remitted judgment. And they would not accept that amount. They chose instead to appeal. So at the time of the deposit, the Roach 4, I'll call it, was still up on appeal. The remitter issue had not yet been decided. When we deposited it, we deposited under the strength of the remitted judgment. It was our position that the remitted judgment was everything that the plaintiffs were going to be entitled to, and they disputed that. They wouldn't accept that and give us a full satisfaction. So we really had no alternative but to place that money into a court under a Rule 67 deposit, because that was the status of the proceeding. At that time, the order from this court on the remitter came about after, well after the deposit. So that was really our only option, was to deposit, other than just give the money carte blanche to the Roaches and then let them proceed along with their appeal.
Yes, so, but couldn't you have signed a partial satisfaction of judgment and reserved the appeal rights? Well, I mean, because as I understand the argument, it's basically that you're claiming that remitter included all the damages, yes, and they're saying it did not. And you're not disputing that the remitter would stand. You're not contesting that. That's the least they can get. Why not, if you're so sure about your argument, why not provide them with the partial satisfaction of judgment? And then the court will decide which, if it included everything or if it didn't.
Well, I guess all I can say about that, Your Honor, is that when we made that deposit, and of course for months leading up to the deposit, we felt very strongly that based on the language of the remitter order, that it was all inclusive. It included attorney's fees, punitive damages.
Well, I understand that, but aren't you basically then saying that you're willing to pay it, but it's a conditional payment?
Well, we're,
if you waive all your other alleged rights.
Well, we're willing to pay it. We still have the argument to the Minnesota Supreme Court. They accepted review on the remitter, but I'd like to add this, and maybe this is somewhat splitting the baby somewhat. We have an excess of $500,000 on deposit. I understand the Roaches want more. Whether they're entitled to more is presently before the Minnesota Supreme Court on review. Under the present status of the district court's deposit order, and we might be overlooking this fact, because the Roaches attorney, and I believe everybody is focusing on the second half of that order that says it can be released on stipulation if it is for a full satisfaction of judgment. But the first part of that order is that those funds can be released upon further order of the court. So there would have been nothing to stop the Roaches from pursuing the release of those funds at this point. and still maintaining and pursuing this appeal. And so it seems to me, Your Honor, that the least that should happen is that the defendants should be exonerated from post-judgment interest, at least on the amount of the deposit. And then what happens after that, if there's more money damages awarded on attorney's fees, then we can deal with the post-judgment interest at that time. And I think that would be a reasonable compromise here, because under the order, the Roaches can pursue a request for those funds. The order, as I say, is basically twofold. You either
right,
get
but you funds. You could also just pay it with a satisfaction of that amount paid while recognizing their ability to seek more in the Supreme Court. Because I honestly don't see how you're ever going to have a judgment that's less. I mean, do you?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, no. I mean, you.
So then you lose the benefit of that money to earn interest on, but the plaintiffs who are never going to get anything less are losing the opportunity to make money on that right now, which is what I think the post-judgment interest is about, is who should be able to make money on money.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I guess my point is, you know, the money has been there since May of this year, and you know, the Roaches could have pursued at least the you know, receipt of those funds if they had wanted to. You know, they chose not to, instead taking this appeal. So I mean, it seems to me that that amount of deposit has never been in dispute. So at least on that amount, there should not be any post-judgment interest from the date of the deposit.
Can I just ask you, I mean, because you're making the argument that they have immediate access to the money and all they have to do is make a motion to the court. I assume that's your argument. Is that, am I correct on that?
They could do that. Yes.
Okay. But if the court has taken the position that this includes everything, and that this, and that they have no further rights, I mean, how is that a viable solution for them?
Well, you know, not to use you know, this raging political word, but your office has essentially trumped that, Your Honor, by the Court of Appeals decision that said the remittiture is not necessarily the be-all, end-all, and all-inclusive. So at this point, the landscape has in fact changed, and pending further review from the Minnesota Supreme Court anyway, at least at this point, they can get those funds. So I think that's the difference now. The landscape has changed, and so the you know, the money is there and has been there for quite some time. I hope that.
Great. Thank you. Did you have more to wrap up? Otherwise we'll.
I don't know how the court would receive this, but it seems to me that perhaps, and I'm not going to pretend to tell the court how to do their job, but it seems to me with the review pending before the Minnesota Supreme Court that it might make sense for this court to defer its decision pending a decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court, because if the Minnesota Supreme Court agrees with the respondents, then that will then place back into play the remitted judgment as the sole option and source of the Roaches fund. So that potentially can change the entire landscape. So my position, either deny the post-judgment interest on the money that's been deposited or defer until we hear from the Minnesota Supreme Court on the remittiter issue.
So thank you for raising that. I had intended to ask about that and I forgot. So that's helpful. None of the parties has moved for a stay of this pending that review. You're suggesting that we could do that. Let's say that I'm trying to understand the practical effect of a Supreme Court's decision. If the Supreme Court decides that either way, that they're entitled, that they can seek more in attorney's fees and pre-judgment, pre-verdict, or whatever the interest was, pre-judgment interest, you know, as the appellant seek, or that they're limited to the remitted judgment. How does that, what impact would that have on a decision that we make today? How does that affect our analysis in deciding whether a deposit of that those funds or a tender of them earlier stops post-judgment interest?
Well, it would, I think it would moot it if the Supreme Court upholds our position on the remittitor and concludes that the remitted judgment was all that the Roaches were entitled to, and that money has been on deposit since May of this year. I think then the impact of the Supreme Court's decision would be, that's it. Pre-judgment, post-judgment, attorney's fees, you name it. It's all wrapped up in that remitted judgment. So I think it could very well moot any decision before this court on the present appeal.
It would moot it because they should have at that time taken the tender subject to a full release, because it turns out they didn't have a right to pursue, or they didn't have an appeal to pursue. Is that it?
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Counsel for appellants, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And if you could also speak to in that time, whether you think that a Supreme Court decision would actually moot a decision here, or how that would impact this case. Thanks.
Let me start with the last question you just asked. It would not moot the remitted judgment. My clients still don't have that money. Roughly $500,000, give or take, is still not in their hands. It's the court has that. They could have paid that and still objected that we can't go forward with appealing separate and distinct issues. But it doesn't moot the fact that we're entitled to $500,000. They didn't pay it. And so it doesn't moot it, because we still don't have the money, and we still deserve post-judgment interest on the money. Now, so let me start at the beginning. The judgment will never go down. Everybody agrees with that. They were trying to hold up payment or blackmail us in the beginning. You want the $500,000? That we want a complete release of your claims for attorney's fees and pre-judgment interest between 16 and 18, and that's part of the appeal to the Supreme Court. If you want to get your $500,000 now, we'll give it to you, but we want a complete release. That's not a tender. The tender has to be without conditions. They were trying to blackmail us to hold us up for that. And now, as of 7/28, the question could be asked. They now know that their position that accepting the remitter ends the whole case. They now know that that's not the law as it stands today. The law today is that accepting a remitter on future damages does not eliminate our opportunity to appeal. So they could have paid as of July 28th the $529,000, and then they could have, and that would stop interest from running, whatever the interest is. But the interest is under 549.09, it's judgment interest, 10% under the statute until it's paid. And paying it into court doesn't pay it to the plaintiffs, because it's not accessible to them. And that, of course, is one of the three requirements for a valid tender. It has to be unconditional, and it has to be accessible to the plaintiffs. You don't just say, oh gosh, it accrues 10%, but you can't have it. We're leaving it with the court until, and I don't know what the reason will be now that the Court of Appeals had said that it doesn't end the litigation. And so So I don't know what the next reason for holding the money is, but they ought to pay the money. It's never going to go down. We're not going to give them a complete release of everything until the, well, you've spoken now. So we're pursuing our appeal. So anyway, the remitted judgments should still get post-judgment interest under 549.09. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, all counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.
Thanks. Thank you.